Hey everybody, Jimmy Warren here. Welcome to a new edition of Guitar Talk Television in our new series, The Business of Guitar. You're in for a real treat today. My guest is the one and only Billy Sheenan. You might know him as the bass player for Steve Vai, the Sons of Apollo, the Winery Dogs, David Lee Roth, and many, many more. We had an opportunity to sit down and talk about what it takes to lay a good, firm foundation in order to become a working musician. This is a great, great conversation with Billy. I think you're really going to enjoy it. So do yourself a favor. Have a seat, put your feet up, get a nice cool beverage, and enjoy this conversation about the business of guitar with the one and only Billy Sheenan right here on Guitar Talk TV. And I thought one of the perfect people to talk to about carving out a career, you know, playing guitar or bass would be you.
All right.
Because you've made a lifetime career of it. And so I figured you probably had some good nuggets of wisdom and insight in that.
Nuggets of something.
Yeah. So if you don't mind, you know, you've been around a long time, man. You've played with a lot of great people. You've accomplished a lot of great stuff. And so, you know, my train of thought is that there's probably a million guys out there that want to be Billy Sheenan, you know, to some degree.
Maybe two or three.
Yeah, oh, no, there's more than that. You know, there's more than that. And so, you know, I thought I'd pick your brain on, you know, what the road has kind of been like in order to, you know, to get where you are. I know that's a vast thing. I understand that, but you know,
well, there's certainly certain points I think that everyone would have in common as far as success in any endeavor, be it playing bass or guitar or starting a hamburger restaurant. I mean, I think there are common denominators in all of it. You know, this, of course, music is an art form and musicians are artists, so there are some special conditions in that respect. But it's a good point and it's a good subject. And I often do seminars and master classes and things of that nature, and they're mostly more motivational than informational, if you will, yeah. Because I like to see people do well. I like to see people succeed. And it's frustrating to watch someone go the wrong way or do something that I know from past experience probably won't work. So I do my best to guide my fellow musicians, generally from the generation after mine, to help them out. I do enjoy helping people very much. So I'd be happy to answer anything you might care to bring up.
You bet. Well, it seems like today, because the music industry seems to be so different today than it probably was, you know, in the 80s and 90s and that. And it seems like today more so than ever, a musician has to be multifaceted. In other words, you have to not only be able to play live, but you have to be able to maybe give lessons or do clinics or, you know, a variety of different ways, create online content, a variety of different ways to be able to carve out a living now, because it's different today, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, but again, there are where there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah.
I myself don't give lessons. I do master classes, for lack of a better name, where I sit down one-on-one or sit down with a group of people and show them, you know, how I came up with what I did and maybe inspire them to either follow a version of that path or create their own path. I think that it's important that people don't start giving lessons until they actually have accomplished something. And I see oftentimes people as, instead of going into a career, they start giving lessons. And my question is, well, what do you, if you haven't done it, what are the value of your lessons? It's like people that want to be a teacher. You know, they see, you know, what would you like to be when you grow up? I'd like to be a teacher. Well, wouldn't it, you know, what are you going to teach? All you're going to teach is what they've told, what you've read to teach. Yeah. You read the syllabus, I think that's what it's called in an educational system, but you haven't done anything. You haven't experienced anything. The greatest educational experience for me, in many ways, was woodshop, because we had a spectacular craftsman, Mr. Hodge at Kenmore East Senior High School, and he was a brilliant man, and he knew how to explain everything. And from it, you could extrapolate the understanding of the entire universe from knowing how to do that one thing. And that and English, to learn the language is essential to anyone. Your fluidity and facility with English is prime foundation for everything you're ever going to know from that point on, or you're ever going to explain to anyone from that point on. So just a couple of points there that may not be exactly on the subject, but may frame it up a little bit more. Music business is always changing. When I started, everybody wanted to be in a band. Everybody wanted to play an instrument, drums, guitar, bass, horns, keyboards, whatever. The Beatles exploded. Prior to that, music was a big deal anyway. So when the Beatles exploded, they came onto very fertile territory. Everybody was into music. Everybody listened to the radio. Everybody bought records. And you could define groups of people by what they listened to. You know, in school, we had these various this balkanization of the Stones people, or the Beatles people, or the psychedelic people, or the Hendrix people. You know, but they were all into something. Yeah. And there was a lot of cross-pollination between those groups as well, which is another great thing that we don't see as much today. People are kind of, they want just this kind of music and nothing else other than that, or just this one band or two bands, where we listen to everything. So now the value of one situation compared to another, it's in your choices. You know, I don't know that one way is right or wrong, but I do know that you've got to really love what you do, no matter what it is you do. Otherwise, you're just slugging it out on the job, making your pay, and hopefully doing something in your spare time that keeps you mentally fit, if you will. So I started out at a time when there was bands everywhere. Every street, every block had a band. You'd drive, walk on a summer night, and as one band's sound would fade out behind, you could hear another one coming up on down the street. As you drive down the street, you could see drum kits set up in people's houses. Everybody, furniture stores would push some of their stock to the side and open up a guitar section. So it was an amazing explosion. And from that, millions of musicians and tens of millions of songs and performances were created. Now, it's different. We don't have the kind of scene where you can go out and play live. Doesn't mean it's not possible. It just means you've got to start putting your thinking cap on and get creative. Many times back in Buffalo, New York, where I grew up and started playing, we got creative with gigs. You know, there was a quarry where people swam called Hard Rock Quarry. And we said to them at one point, well, why don't you put up a stage and like have bands on Saturday? Well, they did. And it became a venue not only for us, but they started bringing national acts in. Same thing as Crystal Beach over the bridge in Canada. This beautiful beach and this big hill behind it. So why don't we run Powers, do a stage, and have bands? And they did. So we created a lot of gigs. And we go to clubs that didn't have bands and set up in the corner for an acoustic night or whatever. Until pretty soon, we have one club we played at the Barrelhead in West Seneca. We started Talus Tuesdays. Tuesday night. That's not a hot night of the week by any means. And within about a year was the hottest night in town. There was lines out the door, and everybody had to go to Talus Tuesdays at the Barrelhead. So within every musician and every person, I believe you have the goods to create almost anything. Yeah. And if you really love it and you really want it bad enough, and you have a burning desire to make it, I believe it will happen. It ain't easy. It ain't ever easy. It never has been easy. Yeah. Back then, the deal, you had to get a record deal to go anywhere, and getting a record deal was tough. And I've got my iTunes full of tens of thousands of garage bands and their recordings from the 60s. None of them ever made it. None of them. Nothing ever happened with any of them. So it's tough. But I also have amazing bands that made it and were huge all over the world. So I do believe if you really have a burning desire to get somewhere, you can get there, no matter what the time period. Now is a different thing. But we'll look at the advantages. On my little laptop computer here, I can have the equivalent, actually greater than, far greater than the equivalent of the most expensive studio in the world. Yeah. Right here with a couple of programs and some software. Yep. And there, we can do things now that we could not have possibly done then. Yep. And it would have cost a fortune to do it then. Now you can download free software and record. Unbelievable. And then with your laptop, you are a few clicks away from practically every human being on earth if you wanted to start to promote. So, wow, that's an amazing thing. Yeah. It's easy to start looking negative because, oh, there's no more clubs and we don't have the scene we used to have. No, but there's something else. Is it better or worse? Not necessarily. It's just evolved. It's different in that respect, I think. But and a lot of guys sit there on YouTube and do their thing, and it's fabulous, and they get a lot of clicks, and then they make some money off it. It's not my thing. I need to be on stage performing live. For me, that's my thing. That's my environment. That's what I do. That's what I love. I live to play live, and I play live to live. That's the thing. But if someone's doing something different, it doesn't mean it's a bad thing or invalid in any by any means. Right. In the future, we may look back. Yeah, remember the YouTube scene? Man, it was great. The scene today is nothing like that. Remember, we could go on YouTube and just do our thing and get thousands of likes. It was fantastic. Now, today, it sucks, you know. So I'm sure that will happen at some point, where people will look back at the scene now and go, "Oh, those are the good old days, man. If we could only do it like that again." It's just human nature. That's the way it works. I think things evolve and things change. And if you get positive about things, there's some amazing things going on right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it seems as if this time in history right now has opened some doors, and I don't know, I want to say forced, but it seems like it's kind of pushed people to get outside of maybe the box that they've always been in or their comfort zone that they've been in to do things that, because I personally think, you know, a lot of the bands and artists that have gone on to do things on social media and stuff during this downtime where they're playing live or giving some sort of, you know, seminar or lesson or whatever, it creates a whole different audience for them than they might have had prior to, you know. It's like, you know, hundreds of thousands of people can now pay attention to you directly, you know, that you weren't being paid attention to by before because you were over here doing something else. Mm-hmm. And now you're here. But, you know, a good house has to have a foundation, right? I mean, that's the starting point for anything. And so in order to develop yourself into, you know, develop music into a career, there has to be a foundation.
Yes. So
for some people, that's learning music in theory and that, and other people, it's just, you know, the live experience, you know, really knowing how to work live and communicate well with others. What would you say that foundation should be?
It depends on what you want. For you to become a classical musician, a real musician, I would start to study and go deep and find an amazing mentor and sit there. And when I see those people, dedication and determinism that it takes to become a classical musician is, and the competition is fierce and vicious. Wow, that's a tough thing. So that's a different foundation. I play basically, to some degree, popular music, mostly rock, mostly heavy rock, done a lot of other things. So that's how I grew up. That's the foundation I poured for myself. Mm-hmm. And I made it 18 inches thick with steel rebar by performing live constantly since I was old enough to get fake ID and go into a club and start playing and playing high school dances and playing constantly. Now, that was a great thing. How do you mimic that now? How do you mimic the advantages of that to a person now? I'm sure there's a way. For me, I got to play live to keep my hands in shape. So now 2 years off where I haven't been able to play live, my hands should be useless. And I should be back down to very poor skills because they're not being used live. So I had to come up with a way to work out on this in a way. And practicing, I've tried practicing before, even before a tour, even when I was playing. And the first week or two of the tour is awful because your hands aren't in shape. Even though you practiced your ass off prior to that tour, it's hard to mimic that strength that you need to perform live. So I did. I came up with ways of exercising my hands and ways of working out and spending more and more time on it. And I did a show, my only show I've done in 2 years in Buffalo, New York for Christmas. We do a Christmas show every year. And it was not bad. It was okay. I was worried. I had a little solo section to do on one song. I'm thinking, this could be a catastrophe. But it came off all right. So my little program to keep my hands in live shape, though I needed to really work at it, I managed to do it. So it is possible to build some sort of foundation no matter what. So you get a playlist of your favorite songs that you know how to play, set up in your garage, stand there and play along with those records, or pick 40 songs and learn them all and play them all and play along with a record on all of them. That could be a great way to really familiarize yourself with a great song, how it's arranged, how you play within it, singing along too. If you're singing, it's always an advantage. I often say to young players, here's the formula that is almost, it was pretty much undeniable when you run the numbers. Get in a band with songs that you sing. Bang. That covers almost everybody that's been successful in the music business. Almost everyone. There are exceptions, of course. But they have American Idol and The Voice and all these programs on TV. You don't see bass players, drummers, or guitar players on there. You see singers on there. So you got to sing. You got to sing songs. You got to sing great songs. And to do that, you need a band. And a band is the conduit, the perfect thing where you have two, three, or four guys together or more going forward with ideas. That's been the tried and true way for you to learn music, learn how to deal with people, cooperate with your fellow musicians, co-create with them. It's a great, great way to go. That's why the YouTube phenomenon of sitting around in your bedroom and playing, great. I'm not taking anything away from that. But until you get in a band, until you start to play songs, because the guys will send me, hey, check us out on bass. And this is an unbelievable, amazing thing. The guy's unbelievable. And I go, that's great, bro. But what? Now what do you do? Now where are you going to go with it? You can't necessarily walk up on stage and just do that. Maybe you can. Yeah, I could be wrong there too. But when I started doing shenanigans on bass and soloing around and stuff like that, I had already been playing for years and years. And we had, you know, we're playing My Generation medley by The Who, and I had to do the bass solo in the middle of that. So I started getting used to it slowly, and then finally happened. I didn't start out by, hey, look at this giant, this Prokofiev piece I learned on bass. Great. Mind-blowing, better than me by far, but I don't know where you're going to take that. So I think there is a way to come up with some kind of strategy that will get you where you want to be. And if you want to perform, and even if you want to do just the YouTube thing, which is perfectly valid and cool, by doing that other thing, you're going to be better at it. It's going to be better, and you're going to learn how to present it better. Well, and how to speak about it better, and performing in front of an audience or speaking in front of a crowd, those are skills that you can develop, and they will help you in many facets of your life. So, yeah. I'm talking too much here, aren't I? I'm sorry.
Oh no, you're great, man. This is really good. You know, my son is really an amazing guitar player. I hate to pat him on the back, but I'm going to for a minute because he's my son, right? So one day when we started to realize how good he was, he had learned how to play Tender Surrender, the Steve Vai version of Tender Surrender. in just a couple of hours just by watching the video of Steve playing it, right? And he was playing it, I mean, just spot on. It sounded flat out amazing. And he went on to, you know, to be able to play really, really well. But when you put him in a setting with a band, like when I would say, why don't you sit in with our band, and that he couldn't play at all. I mean, he was lost. He had no clue as to where to go. And as a matter of fact, it was so uncomfortable for him that he never, ever got in a band at all. And eventually, you know, the guitar just went to the wayside. It's something that he just picks up every now and then. I think the live experience, or I should say the conversation that you get to enjoy with other musicians, is really one of the most amazing aspects of being a musician.
I agree. And it is really a way to discover a lot about yourself and a lot about how you deal with others and socializing yourself. We live in a world right now, especially now, that where people are compartmented off from one another. And when you're walking in a store, you don't even see people's expression anymore. Hey, how are you? Nice to see you. Or, I think you should put that down. You know, you can't even express emotion anymore. So it's a tough thing. So getting in a band and that interactivity, when I play, me and the drummer, that's a thing, whatever drummer I play with, because bass and drums are where it's at. And I lock onto the drummer and I study what he does and how he does it so I can follow him and get us woven together in a very tight weave that is impenetrable. Just really get that together. And then extend that over to vocals and other instruments where you're laying a foundation for them, enhancing them, getting out of their way, leading them down a path, bringing them back from a path they went down by mistake, all kinds of things that you do as a player. And it's quite interesting to see it in action. I'm now doing a lot of tracks out of my house, or people email me from all over the world and send me their tracks and ask me to play bass on it. And I do. And it's been a great experience, because we hear this track with no bass and we're thinking, me and my engineer are thinking, I don't know, man, this is a... Let's try this. And suddenly, there's a song there. I mean, the bass is interesting. I'm not saying me and my bass or my playing, but I'm saying just the bass and any bass player. If bass done right, wow, you really can make or break a piece of music with bass. It's quite awesome. So it's the example you said about your son and getting socialized and learning how to do it with people. That's one of the great things about my generation of players, is this was your key.
Yeah.
It was a party Saturday night. Are you invited? No. I got one of these. Come on in. You know, it was the way you that opened doors for you everywhere. And school, anybody, well, I could bring my guitar. And, oh, really? Well, bring it in. You know, and the next thing you know, well, I got a guitar too. Hey, and next thing we had a band and all kinds of things like that happened. So the socialization that happens from people playing is a great thing. And then you go to a show and you look out at the crowd and everybody's there. There's festivals in Europe with thousands of people and everybody goes to all these festivals and they know each other and they hang out and it's a riot and it's a way of life for a lot of people. So yeah, I'm sorry that your son lost interest, but it's tough. It's tough. There are a lot of, all along the way, there's going to be these little parts that are your stop. You either get over it or you make a left turn and go somewhere else. And it's filled with them all the way up. And even at the top, there are many of them up there as well. So it's tough. If it was easy, I don't think it would be nearly as valuable.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it is so tough. You've got to, and I gave up so much of my life. You know, I never had kids. I didn't get married until later, way later in life, because I was too busy. I had to play. I had things to do, and I had to attend to stuff constantly. And so I made a lot of sacrifices as a result. And all my money when I was really young, all my money went into gear and or something related to my forward motion in the music biz, if you will. So it was there was a lot of sacrifices. But in the end, if you're the gods shine down on you and you're lucky. Yeah. Wow. It is mind blowing. And it also, another great thing, I believe, that is a great benefit from getting some kind of success. You can help a lot of people. You can help out a lot of people. I mean, by encouraging people, or even I put out music and people have liked it, and I get emails from people that were, you know, considering committing suicide, but they were listening and it changed their point of view, and now they're back on top, and it brings tears to your eyes. And I got a huge folder of amazing, the effect you can, the positive effect you can have on people is unbelievable. So there's a lot more to it than money or fame. I've never been into fame, or really not that much into money either. I've never been motivated by either one. I just wanted to do my best. I wanted to be better than I was yesterday. I wanted to top myself, top it again, and then go from there and even go more and more and more and more, which doesn't mean faster and faster. It could mean groovier and groovier, cooler and cooler, more stylistic. It could be many, many things. But that was my goal. And then a little side payment for it was the fact that I've been just lucky to be able to affect people in a positive way, in such a way that they write to me often and I hear about it, or I hear about, you know, I went to see you back in 1982 and I met my wife there and now we have kids and we, you know, we always put your records on, and you know, it's unbelievable the effect you have on people. And as a result, I got friends all over the world, great, great people that are dear, trusted friends, quite amazing. So there's more to it than money and fame. And if money and fame are your goals, I would get into, maybe banking or insurance or something like that, because I think you can make way more money at it. And like I said, and most bands that I knew were never really money motivated. They just wanted to, be on stage and play and enjoy that moment. So that's an important thing.
So there's fame in the insurance industry.
if there's money involved, there's fame no matter what.
Yeah, because, you got a point. So let me ask you this, Billy. I mean, you know, in order to hone your craft, you know, into what you have, you know, there was a time years ago where you were in the formative days of developing Billy Sheehan into who he is today. What do you think are some of the key things that you did that have made you the player that you are right now?
Well, most of it was pretty inadvertent. I didn't have a grand plan. Say, okay, we're going to do this and now this next. And then I was just stumbling along, a rudderless ship on a windless sea, blowing through the across the oceans. But I was playing constantly. I was performing every night. One time we did three full shows in one day. 21 nights in a row was our record, though I've probably since done at least that or more. So it was constant. So in order to do that, you have to be in a state of mind to really concentrate on what you're doing. And you're doing so much, you're playing, you're singing, you got to get on stage on time. You got to have so much together that it's almost like the military. You have to have so many ducks in a row in order to make this thing pull this thing off. So it was a discipline. So inadvertently, I became disciplined in that particular field, which meant also that I had to practice a lot, and I wanted to learn a lot, and I was intrigued and excited by a lot of music. I would hear some new thing come out, but wow, what? Wait, can I play that on bass? Let me see. It is a, you know, oh yeah, okay. And we'd figure some cello part or some keyboard thing or something beyond the bass, which helped expand my understanding of the instrument and of music. So I remember people would come to my little apartment in Buffalo and knock on the door, and I'd answer and have the bass on. They say, "Don't you ever take that thing off?" And I said, "No, actually, I don't. I'm working here. You know, come on in, hang on, have your thing. But I got things to do." Or I'd be driving somewhere and I get excited about some idea I'd have on bass. I go, "Oh, I got to get home. I got to remember this so I can remember now. What would happen if I, you know?" So there was a real relentless drive to get somewhere, and I didn't know where it was going to take me. I didn't know if it was going to be a good thing or a bad thing, or where it would end up. But that constant desire to move forward, to get better, to refine, to expand, understand more music, listen to wider variety of music, all those things eventually led up to me being able to write, being able to compose, somebody would come to me with a song. What would you play on bass? Try this. Wow. I would have never thought of that. Cool. There's the bass line. So that, which led to having songs that eventually ended up getting recorded that were part of albums with hit records. And so all those things eventually formed into this unified theory, but it was pretty nebulous for a long time. It didn't really have there was no point on that sword, but it was traveling in a forward direction. So I think I would recommend, pardon me, I would recommend to a young player, just get rolling, start learning songs. Every band that I love, pretty much almost every single one, it came from my generation or a couple other layers of generation after me, they played copy tunes. The Beatles' first album, Taste of Honey, Please Mr. Postman, Twist and Shout, there were copy tunes. I got the Beatles' first demo that they sent to, I think EMI in England was their label. There's 20 songs on it. Guess how many were originals?
I don't know. Yeah.
Not one. Yeah. Now, here's probably one of the greatest writing bands of all time. And here they are sending their demo to the record label without a single original on it. Amazing. Yeah, so that tells us something, that, and every artist will copy from the artists that came before them. Not only musicians, architects do it, painters do it, sculptors do it, writers do it. Hunter S. Thompson, there's a famous story that I've got to look up what the book was, but he took a famous novel, classic novel, like not War and Peace, that would be pretty long to do, but something like that, some iconic novel, sat with a typewriter and typed out the entire novel just to get what it would be like, what it would feel like to write a book like that.
Wow.
Amazing. So yes. it's not just musicians that do it. Architects too, they study other people's architects, and great painters would, in their training, would often have to paint one of the master's painting. You got to do the Mona Lisa or the Last Supper or whatever else, just to get an idea. How would you do that? How could you take a little, some bristles and some colors and make an image that will go through the centuries as an inspiration to people? How do you do that? Well, try to do it. Try to paint the Mona Lisa. You may not get that close, but at least that's how you train. And then when you later on go on to do whatever it is you do, there's a foundation there. And almost every artist in every field will tell you the same thing. You learn by copying. And so start copying. Find great players. And great players and great songs and great hits. Because you can copy the obscure oddball things that never really went anywhere. And that's cool. But that'll lead you, you know, down a path that you may not want to go. But we're learning great songs by great artists that are iconic songs that have stood the test of time, and learning them, learning how to play them and sing along with them. Man, and plus it's a lot of fun. It's a riot. I got my 12-string guitar over here. I sit down and start singing old Bowie songs and Hendrix and Bebop Deluxe and Crosby, Stills and Nash and Three Dog Night and all these hit records, great songs that I knew and I loved and I played when I was a kid. And man, it gets my voice in shape, gets my ears in shape. When I gotta compose now, they say good writers write and great writers steal. Yeah. And it's very true in many ways, because nothing is really original. I mean, no matter what you're playing me, I'll probably be able to say, yeah, that comes from a song, but here, let me find it in my iTunes. I'll play a song that sounds almost exactly like it. There's nothing wrong with that. And I don't believe in stealing, of course. But you're influenced by everything that came before you, and you'll see it. To do something completely original would mean you'd have to get like hammers and screwdrivers and play on lawn furniture. That would be original. But this has been used a lot. Almost every note on here has ended up on a record somewhere. So we got to kind of reconfigure. But learning from copying other artists is a great, great thing. That's how we learn our language, and music is a language. You learn from your mom and your dad, brothers, sisters, and friends what to speak and what to say and how to say it with what emotion and how it happens. That's all learned by copying people as we grow up. So this is a language that also, why not learn it in that fashion? Now, to learn written music properly, righteously, yeah, that's an amazing, just like learning how to write as opposed to just speak. So learning how to read and write, yeah, it's a very, very important thing for language. You'll see, hear people that don't read a lot mispronounce things because they didn't know, they never heard it pronounced properly or spelled out correctly to know how it is to structure a sentence in that proper way. Now, it doesn't mean it's not a proper thing to say, but it's interesting to see people who read a lot and people who just speak and don't read, the differences in the way they communicate. It's interesting.
Yeah, well, I'm illiterate that way because I go through phases, you know. It's like I don't read a whole lot, you know, but I'm from Chicago. I'm from the Chicago area, right? And when I started playing music, I was surrounded by all the old Chicago blues guys, you know, the Tyrone Davises and Junior Wells and Sun Seals and, you know, all the, you know, in the city of Chicago, these are iconic guys. And that's where I cut my teeth and I started out. And after 9 albums, I realized that I had never tried to do anything really original. I had always tried to be, you know, in that vein with those guys, in that, and although I've loved all kinds of music and I've listened to all kinds of music, everything I always played was in that vein. And I'm saying that to say this, the one thing that I found out that really, really helped me as a musician was I started a David Gilmour tribute band because I love David Gilmour. And that took my playing, I mean, leaps and bounds from where it ever was before, because I had never, ever really studied anybody the way that I studied David in order to be able to do those shows. And so I can see what you're saying is absolutely correct, you know?
Yeah, it always will expand your horizons to do that. Growing up, the band that was in Talis, I drove them crazy because I always had some harebrained crazy idea to do some song that was way out of our range. And, but it, in the end, it always worked. So I heard about this band called The Tubes. They had a song called White Punks on Dope. And the song was almost an orchestral piece that synthesized full choir, everything like that. And we were a 3-piece band. I kept like, come on, we got to. So we did White Punks on Dope. We did Carry On Wayward Son by Kansas, 3-piece. We did Schizoid Man by King Crimson, which was way out, but it changed the whole focus of the band to people that looked at us like actual musicians, that we knew what we were doing. We could play a piece like that and gave credibility to everything else we did. So when we did Joy to the World, Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog by Three Dog Night, that had a little more credibility to it now because we also do Schizoid Man, Carry On Wayward Son, and White Punks on Dope. So, you know, so it's broadening your horizons is always a good thing. I listen, I have a huge iTunes collection. It's over 2 terabytes and it's well curated. All the album art is there. All the song titles are correct. I go over it with a fine tooth comb. I spent hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours on it. And I have some of the most amazing, I kind of have two extremes I go to. I've got some of the most amazing music you've ever heard in your life that you may not have known about. It'll blow your mind. And I've got some of the worst music and the most horrible songs and catastrophes that were ever recorded. And
it's an interesting,
what's that?
So you got all 9 of my albums.
But and it's interesting to hear horrible music.
Yeah,
because at one point somebody was in the control room and went, "All right, that's good," and it wasn't. So pretty interesting phenomenon there. But I'm a fan too, and I love listening to music. Most great players I know, and not including myself, are into music. I know Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top will He knows so much about so many things. But, you know, he would know if you brought up some obscure artist, he probably has it on red vinyl, white vinyl, and the Edison cylinder version of it, if you will. You name it. So he's got it. And most everyone else I know is that they have some degree of real interest in great music that they listen to. I listen to a lot of classical music. I don't know a lot about it, but we used to have a little contest back in the first put Mr. Big together. A lot of bands were imitating each other, and we told people, yeah, we're kind of modeling the band after, kind of like a Free, Humble Pie, Spooky Tooth. And nobody knew who Spooky Tooth was. I knew who it was. And then we'd have other bands say, yeah, I don't got to like Spooky Tooth. And I said, well, what song by Spooky Tooth? Well, all of them. You know, was there anyone in particular? They didn't know. So we started separating people out by the ones who were making up stories. And then we'd have a thing, can you name 30 classical composers? And that was the criteria. And I could. I don't know if I could now, but I could then. And my guitar player, Mr. Big Paul, he could. But you kind of use that as our little test. So yeah, you're into classical music. Oh, great. Because everybody would say they're into classical music to kind of take on that air and impress everyone. I said, well, give me 30 classical composers. Yeah. And that would separate the wheat from the chaff, as Crosby, Stills, and Nash might say.
That's great stuff. I tell you what, Billy, man, I've absolutely enjoyed this conversation with you.
Thank you. Myself too. I enjoyed speaking with you.
I want to say this before I go, though. You know, I've seen you play many times, and the thing that I absolutely love, and probably everybody else does too, but the thing I absolutely love is when you and Richie Kotzen do those runs together. I mean, I'm always blown away. You know, some of the songs that you guys do where you do those elaborate runs together is just absolutely amazing. Always blows me away.
Well, Richie's quite a talent, and I enjoy working with him a lot. Plus, he's playing with his fingers, so we have a little, they work together in a way that's not better or worse than a pick player and myself. So it was kind of interesting the way they work together in that respect. That's the Winery Dogs. We have a new record we're working on, and everything's taken so much time with the pandemic insanity. So we've had a Talus record, brand new one, done for a couple of months now, and we're still working on getting it all squared away and get it out. New Winery Dogs is not done, but it's getting closer. And I've done, like I said, here recording at home, I've done about 6 records with various people and about 300 tracks for people around the world. So it's been a busy time, and that's good. But I'm glad you appreciate what we do in the Winery Dogs. It's one of my favorite endeavors I've ever been involved in.
One of the best bands that's ever come around, in all honesty.
Thank you.
It really is. I mean, you guys, every time I've seen you, I'm a huge Richie Kotzen fan as it is as a guitar player. And when Richie went from playing with a pick to playing with his fingers, he just shot off, in my opinion, you know?
Yeah, it's a good way to make yourself a little bit unique too. I mean, in the early days, bass was played with a pick also, but I went with the finger things, particularly Tim Bogert was a big influence on me, and he was a finger style player. And some of the things he did, you really can't do with a pick. You need this, or maybe somebody can. I certainly can. But then on purpose, I would go back sometimes now, and I'll get a pick. I use the famous Stone picks from the 70s. This is from the 70s. A company called Mind, MIND, Mind as in mining, and Mind as in your mind, the Mind picks. I have 3 of them left, because if you drop them, they break sometimes. And sometimes I'll purposely play with a pick just to throw myself off and walk down a different path, come back, and you've got some new thing. So I would always purposely try to throw myself a curve on purpose to and then have to get over it. And then I've got somewhere in my bag of tricks another little possible skill that may serve me someday. Who knows?
Well, you seem to have quite a bit in your toolbox, that's for sure, Billy.
Yeah, I think it's important to have not only for your playing skills, but also sonically and mentally, a big library of that you can access. That's why I've just realized now that's why I'm so obsessed with the iTunes collections that I have, because it really is a great source of inspiration and research, and curating all that and being exposed to it all the time. I mean, I get a glass of wine coming down here, and after I get done playing for a while and get in there and start playing, you know, the demos for Sergeant Pepper by the Beatles and Robin Trower, Day of the Eagle, pre-recorded version with different lyrics and all kinds of amazing stuff. Some Debussy and who was I listening to recently? Debussy and Sir Arnold Bax, a British composer, quite awesome. And a lot of Coltrane lately too, just because it's utterly impossible. I sit there. If I start to think I'm getting good, I'll put something like that and I go, man, I'm clueless. I have no idea what I'm doing. So that'll put me right back in my place again.
Well, you know, you're an amazing player, and I thank you so much for your time, Billy. It's been
my pleasure.
Absolute treat talking to you, and I can't wait to get out and see you guys, you know, perform again.
Really, yeah,
to the new album and what you're about to do. So
as soon as possible, I'll post all info on all my social media and any info about anything. So thanks for contacting me and doing this today. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Billy. Stay safe and best of luck in the future. Okay.
Same to you, my brother. Take care.
All right, man. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. I hope you really enjoyed that episode of The Business of Guitar with the one and only iconic bass player, Billy Sheenan. I want to thank Billy so much for participating. Do yourself a favor. Make sure that you're following him on social media and all the different groups that he's a part of, because he's got his hands in a lot of different things. Billy is an incredible talent, and I want to thank him so much. I hope you're enjoying this series, The Business of Guitar. Next week, Carl Verhaeghe, the guitarist from Supertramp, will be on with us. And until then, thank you so much for tuning in to Guitar Talk TV. See you later.